Well, if you have Psalm 123 open in front of you, it will most definitely help you as we work our way through it. Like many of us will probably be familiar with an old comedy sketch from the 60s from a program called The Frost Report. Three men in high order stand in a row. John Cleese in a bowler hat with an umbrella cane, the tallest by at least a foot, turns to his left and says, "I look down on him because I am upper class." And Ronnie Barker in the middle turns to John Cleese and says, "I look up to him because he is upper class." He turns to the man on his left and adds, "But I he is lower class. I am middle class." The diminutive Ronnie Corbett, in a flat cap and a ragged scarf, looks straight at the camera and says, "I know my place." It's a hilarious take on the stratified nature of British society that's still uncomfortably accurate. But it suggests a good question. Do you know your place? Not in terms of the hierarchy of an antiquated class system. But when it comes to God, do you know your place? It seems fairly clear to the psalmist. Look at how this psalm opens. "I lift my eyes to you who sit enthroned in heaven." So borrowing from the two Ronnies, my first point, I've got 2 points this morning. My first point is, I look up to him. Now perhaps it's a bit of a no-brainer. Of course we look up, spiritually speaking, to God. But that very act, the lifting up of the eyes to God, is itself a reminder of who God is. He's not some benevolent old man sitting on a cloud in a white robe like the painters might try and depict it. He's not a tall man in a bowler hat. He is the one who sits enthroned in heaven. Don't try to take this too literally. It's picture language. It's a declaration of the absolute, all-powerful reign of God. He sits ruling in the position of ultimate authority. This isn't a power that can be shaken. This is not someone who can be challenged. Now, if you're sat, you're not worried about someone challenging you, are you? You're sat, you're strong and stable, to borrow from some of the parlance of the times. This is the Ancient of Days. Like we saw in Psalm 121, the maker of heaven and earth. This psalm, as we've seen, is a cry for help. It's petitionary. You can call psalms like this psalms of complaint. That's how some people categorize this type of psalm. They're for singing and praying when there's something wrong that you want God to fix, to address. Often in a psalm of complaint, you don't see a resolution to the psalm. You don't see the answer to the problem given, which makes them so perfectly usable by anyone in a similar or even a fairly dissimilar situation. You're not being asked to dishonestly sing praises for a salvation that hasn't come yet. There are times, as I'm sure you know, where you just need to ask the Lord for help. Now, many psalms like this end with a declaration of God's reliability, with a complaint coming earlier. Maybe it opens the psalm saying, "God, this is wrong, will you fix it?" And then they end by saying, "God is strong and will answer." But the order is completely the other way round here. Some commentators trying to put this in a period of history wonder if perhaps this psalm was written during the time of Nehemiah and Ezra, when they were trying to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem in the face of so much opposition. There are actually some interesting structural and linguistic links to the book of Nehemiah, just in the way this psalm is laid out. So that could be your homework, to read the book of Nehemiah and try and find the parallels in this psalm. But it's certain at least that book 5 of the psalms, that's psalms 107 to 150, were collected together after the return from exile. So whenever this psalm was written, it was gathered together with the psalms of ascent and all these other psalms after the exiles had returned to Israel. Think of those returnees, of people like Nehemiah and Ezra and Zerubbabel and so on. You know, those long lists of names that you get in Ezra and Nehemiah. Think of the hostility of the foreign peoples still occupying parts of Israel. I'm trying to remember them off the top of my head. People like Sanballat and I think Tobiah, people like that. I think of how at that time, even the greatest Jewish rulers at best can hope to be governors under the rule of pagan emperors. There's no Davidic king on the throne of Israel. The walls of Jerusalem are broken. The rebuilt temple was such a pitiful sight compared to its former glory that those old-timers who could remember it wept at the sight. Though there's been a partial return, things are bleak and difficult as Israel suffers the punishment for its many covenant disobediences. Especially when times are bad, you need to remember before you pray who you're praying to. Remind yourself of who you're talking to. Before you start airing your grievances, remember the one you're talking to. He's not your buddy. He's not your servant. He's the one who sits enthroned in heaven. He is great and mighty. And he is capable of dealing with whatever it is his will to deal with. And let that knowledge inform how you sing, how you pray, how you relate to this one up to whom you look. But still, in this first point, you see there's an interesting development, isn't there, in verse 2. I look up to him, verse 2, as the eyes of slaves look to the hand of their master, as the eyes of a female slave look to the hand of the mistress, so our eyes look to the Lord our God till he shows us his mercy. I look up to him as a slave looks to the hand of their master, as a female slave looks to the hand of her mistress. It's all inclusive. It's not just trying to say the men, it's saying men and women, all the community are looking like slaves to the hand of their master. This is the kind of language that makes us uncomfortable. Some translations, maybe if some of you got different Bibles in front of you, it says servant rather than slave. I appreciate the NIV here for its honesty in translating it slave. It's true, of course, that the ancient Hebrew idea of slavery was nothing like the horrors of African slavery, maybe the things that come immediately to your mind when you think of slaves, films like 12 Years a Slave and Amazing Grace, those kind of things. But we're still talking about a system whereby a person, or at very least their labour, was owned by another person. Your master can do whatever he wants with you. The Old Testament has laws that limits the measure of violence you can inflict on your slaves. But do I need to say it? Slaves are slaves. They're not free people. When your master tells you to do something, you don't have a choice about it. You're not going to have a discussion about it. You have to do it. If you don't, he won't dock your pay. He won't start some disciplinary action with the HR department. He's entitled to beat you. There's a beautiful ambiguity to the phrasing of verse 2. You think of how a slave would look to the hand of their master. Are their eyes looking for some signal of command? I think it was Spurgeon pointing out, Eastern peoples, Near Eastern peoples, they're sort of maybe not as vocal as us, and they'll just use gestures more. So he's saying perhaps they're looking for some signal of command, pointing them to fetch water or fetch some food or get a fan to waft them with a cooling breeze. Or are they perhaps fearful of the violence their master has every right to dole out, making sure they're lifted in anger or in violence? Depending on the master, if you were a slave, you could expect either of those things. There's almost a story being told in this psalm. We look up to God, but what should we expect? Well, the answer is right there in the verse. So our eyes look to the Lord our God till he shows us his mercy. Mercy, favor, grace. It's that same Hebrew word for grace, and Noah found grace, favor in the eyes of the Lord. That same word. Grace sits at the heart of this psalm. You notice it's how the first stanza ends and how the second one starts. Mercy, grace, favor. The slave looks up to his master and he's waiting for mercy. It's mercy that he expects. There might be a wait, but God will respond in mercy. Because that is who he is. He's the covenant God, the Lord. He's bound himself to this people living in the ruins of Jerusalem. God didn't save Israel to make his name a byword. He did it for his glory, to show his greatness, his compassion, his loving kindness. And this, by the way, forms this slavery analogy from something that makes 21st century Brits uncomfortable to something very powerful indeed. Now think of the countertext. Think of what it could have said. What if it had compared, instead of slave and master, which we were maybe a little uncomfortable with, what if it had compared God to and his servants to two friends? Now, it's not always a given that you respond when you have a friend in need, is it? You should want to, of course, and it might make you seem like a bad friend, but you as an individual aren't under threat. If someone slaps your friend, it might upset you, but it's not a direct offence against you. But a slave, they're part of the master's household. They're an extension of his might and wealth and glory. If the slave gets mocked or beaten by someone else, it's a great slight to the master. It's an abuse of his honor, his glory. A master might have a right to beat his servant, but no one else does. For someone else to pour scorn on their servant is to slight the honour of the master. This brings me on to my second point. Like I said, 2 points only. Firstly, I look up to him. And secondly, thinking perhaps of poor Ronnie Corbett in that sketch, they look down on me. This is the situation the psalmist faces. There are people who are mocking them, pouring out their scorn on them. Haughty, arrogant, cruel people. Now, it fits perfectly to imagine that this psalm was written during the time of Nehemiah. But even today, I'm sure we can sympathize. Throughout history, God's people have been the butt of many a joke. In fact, if you go home and you look up on YouTube, you want to see that Frost Report sketch with the two Ronnies and John Cleese. In the very same video, if you just click on the first one that comes up, if you type two Ronnies, I know my place, you type that, first video that comes up, you have that sketch, and immediately after is a sketch with John Cleese dressed as a vicar, standing in a pulpit. He says, let him who's without sin cast the first stone, and a big piece of masonry falls on his head. It's a very funny sketch, but it shows what people thought of Christians at the time. They were hypocrites. They were to be the butt of the joke. They were dishonest people to be mocked. Not respected, not treated with love, but made fun of. It's been the same from the very beginning. The Romans, they looked down on Christianity as a primitive Oriental cult. Enlightenment scholars in the 18th century and the 19th centuries, they made the idea of the supernatural seem laughable, like only an idiot would believe in miracles. Even today, it's not changed since 1966, stand-up comedians treat Christians as if it were open season. In many countries around the world, as we tell you, every week, Christians are the target not just of wisecracks, but of bullets. Just in the past few years, I remember hearing about snipers in Syria who would target anyone, especially pregnant women and children, target anyone who was out of their house on a Sunday, because chances were they were going to church. Now, it's hard, I know, to compare the kind of fun made of us by family, friends and colleagues to the violent persecution our brothers and sisters face. But arrogant words wear us down and strip us of any joy in our faith. So we maybe can't compare it on a level, but it doesn't mean that it's not harmful. We have a kind of Western guilt for considering mockery a type of persecution. But the harm it does is genuine. This psalm gives us permission to call on God's help for the scorn we face for being owned by the living God. I like the way some other translations put it. It suggests, that the psalmist has had their fill of scorn. They're literally stuffed, overfed with it. Well, it's the word that they've translated endured in the NIV here is the word means to be full up, to be stuffed. If you eat too much, you're full up in the same way. They couldn't imagine having a bite more, and yet their proud enemies pour down this vindictive bile on them. One Jewish scholar translates these two verses this way, and he captures some of the alliteration of the Hebrew. He says, grant us grace, Lord. Grant us grace, for we are sorely sated with scorn. Sorely has our being been sated with the contempt of the smug, the scorn of the haughty. And this is where we see the benefit of the slavery analogy in verse 2. If you are a Christian, then there are many people who look down on you. In terms of social ranking, you're Ronnie Corbett in that sketch. A poorly dressed, comic figure of fun, assured of the fact that other people think they're better than you. They're not so self-righteous as you. They're not as deluded as you. They're better educated or more progressive or more enlightened than you are. As far as they're concerned, you exist to give them a smug feeling of superiority. What did Jesus say? Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. If you are mocked, if scorn and derision are poured on you, not because you're a self-righteous, hypocritical, unpleasant person. You know, you earn scorn if you're like that. But if you are mocked simply because it's known by your bearing and your behavior that you are a Christian, then you are blessed. As a slave of the Most High, His honor is being mocked. And you can rely on Him to defend it. They look down on me. But remember, verse 1, there is one who sits enthroned in the heavens. Do you know your place? Are you simply under the heel of the proud and the arrogant? Do the great and the good oppress you because you are vulgar? Do you extend your view of those above you on the socio-economic ladder to your vision of the one who sits enthroned in heaven? Do you feel like an ant, puny and despised when you think about God? Is He like a kid with a magnifying glass above you? Is He a cruel and distant taskmaster, over quick to show you the back of His hand, a frowning face looking down from above and disapproving of your every action? When you look to Him, if you do, when you ask Him for help, if you do, when you ask for salvation, when you pray, when you dare to lift the eyes of your mind higher than the mountains, are you simply looking to God like a whipped dog and hoping that He won't be angry with you? Is the best that you can hope from God a day without a beating? Or, on the other hand, do you know that God is your master? Do you know that you are His slave and feel the comfort that comes from such a privileged position? Would you, like David, rather be a doorkeeper in the house of your God than dwell in the tents of the wicked? Do you look for shelter beneath the shadow of His wings? Do you find the Rock of Ages cleft for you to be a refuge, a resting place? When you pray, when you cry out to your Lord, is it with the knowledge that you rely on Him for everything you have and do? And does that knowledge give you comfort because you know He waits to give mercy? You trust that you, as His representative, as one who bears His name on your forehead, are precious to Him. And His honor and purposes are bound up in keeping you safe for the work that He has given you to do. Call on Him with desperate dependence, and lifting your eyes to Him, wait the mercy that He loves to show. Let's stand and sing our final hymn, number 875.